You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
President Trump can now tackle the problems of the American political system, problems that he said he alone could fix. But he starts out with some of the lowest approval ratings ever for a president entering the White House, and his first few days in office have already been marked by a number of controversies. Last week, filmmaker Michael Kirk joined us to discuss the fissures between American politicians and voters, as reported in his PBS Frontline special, The Divided States of America. He has directed and co-written a companion film, this one about how President Trump paved his successful campaign despite what many observers saw as a string of serious missteps. Trump's Road to the White House airs tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country. I'm very pleased it has brought Michael Kirk back to our show.
Great to be here, Leonard.
Before we get to the road just traveled, how's the road looking for President Trump after a couple of days in office? Do you see the ingredients for another frontline special?
Well, my sense is, after having watched him through a film we did in the fall called The Choice, where we had his youth up to his adulthood, then The Divided States of America that you talked about, where the ground was plowed, that he now planted his seeds of whatever's going to happen. My sense now, after the asking the question in the Road to the White House film, of is the way he campaigned, the way he's going to govern, that what just happened over the last 3 days is just exactly what he had in mind.
And the New York Times, although the New York Times called his first weekend rocky, isn't part of his style to stir things up?
Absolutely. It's been since the beginning. Our film tomorrow night really begins with the victory, but it also begins with this phrase, let Trump be Trump. And what that means is chaos. Let chaos be chaos. He broke more rules than any presidential candidate I've ever heard of or ever seen, and I believe that that's his method.
Did he plan that, or is that just the style he's had for years, particularly, and is it particularly suited for this time in American history?
I'm not really sure the word plan fits into the description of Donald Trump, although I think he's ready to adopt a plan here and there based on exigencies, but I think he's really just flying by the seat of his pants.
Robbie Mook, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, compares Trump's win to being smacked by a 2x4. It came out of nowhere, he said. But did it come out of nowhere?
No, not when you watch it closely like we did. If you're having sincere serious psychological difficulties as a result of, and I'm not laughing at it, as a result of watching or hearing about his victory, watching his inauguration address, I think what you'll find when you watch our film is, at least I hope what you'll find is, an understanding that it isn't just magic and it isn't lightning in a bottle time. It's something different than that.
We mentioned Nixon's Southern strategy last week. Have Republicans been campaigning on divisions since the 1960s?
Well, some have, and it's been a difficult road for Republicans.
Maybe even earlier with McCarthy?
Well, you could go way back. But
the New Deal?
Maybe
the
even
Civil War.
Well, let's go even further. No, I think, it depends. And it really does depend on the character who rises up and whatever is going on in the party. The great and interesting irony is that the Republicans, after the 2012 loss to Mitt Romney, did a thing they called the autopsy and came out of it with a belief that if they were ever going to win the White House again, this is almost comedy now, they were going to have to seek the votes of millennials, Latinos, and others. They had to broaden their base with a more compassionate Republicanism. And lo and behold, 4 years later, who is their nominee? A man who took over the Republican Party as a hostile takeover. And as his political guru, Roger Stone, told us, this is a man who didn't care at all about the Republican Party. It was just a place he could run.
Roger Stone, who has been a conservative political consultant since Nixon, were Republicans as taken by surprise as the Democrats?
I think they were. I think as the summer went on, remember in the beginning there were 16 people running against him, and they were called by the Republican establishment the greatest class ever of people, and that's Rubio and Cruz and Jeb, the Anointed One, all the way along lined up to believe that they were going to win. And it wasn't until, and they were just shocked at the razzle-dazzle showmanship of Donald Trump. But as you'll see in the film, when they looked around, before they knew it, he had them. He had every one of them.
Well, you mentioned that the campaign had that rule, let Trump be Trump. Why did Trump's advisors think that would be a winning strategy?
Well, there's the thing about Donald Trump. He doesn't have close advisors, and he doesn't have close friends. He doesn't have basically any real friends. So he has family. He has Ivanka and the two boys and Jared Kushner. He has those people very close to him, and he has lower-level people like Corey Lewandowski at the beginning, who aren't exactly seasoned veterans. Why? He wants to do it. He wants to be himself, and he needs in close the friendship of his children and the sycophantic approaches by others who are not yet at his level. Now, that changes once Bannon and Kellyanne Conway come in. But up until then, after the Republican convention, his closest aides are his children.
When the professionals came in, they said that things would change a bit and he would come under more control. That didn't happen.
The word pivot is a wonderful word that I think got a lot of currency this last summer, as everyone expected Donald Trump to pivot. A pivot at each step of the, all right, he's vanquished all of his Republican opponents. All right, it's time for a convention. All right, he'll pivot now and he'll start to go to the teleprompter and act like a traditional candidate. Nothing like that. Okay, he's in a general election. Now he'll have to pivot. It wasn't ever Donald Trump's intention to pivot. Letting Trump be Trump meant letting it all fly.
How can he sustain his style and still be effective as president? Won't he have to rely on people he barely knows?
Let's just say the sentence you just uttered could have been uttered at the beginning of his campaign, could have been uttered at the beginning of the convention, could have been uttered at the beginning of the general. You know, won't he have to do this or that? We, the press, and others, conventional thinkers, people in the Republican establishment, all, Leonard, I think, believed that at some moment Trump was going to have to start following the rules, and so far he hasn't.
My guest is Michael Kirk, who is the director and co-writer of a PBS Frontline documentary, Trump's Road to the White House, which premieres tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country. Didn't Trump hint at presidential ambitions in the late 1980s, although he denied that on Oprah's show?
In 87, when The Art of the Deal came out, instead of just going on the usual book tour stump, he and Roger Stone decided to create a kind of mock presidency, a presidential candidate. They went to New Hampshire in the Trump helicopter. He got off the helicopter. Stone had put together some of the networks actually showed up. And he put together a couple of little events in Portsmouth there. And Trump spoke at these events. We have the tape of it, and it's almost identical to the things he says in 2016. And he gets in the car at the end of it, Stone tells us, and says, "That's a lot of free publicity, isn't it? Oh, my God." And what was he talking about? He was talking about the problem with the Chinese, the problem with free trade.
The Japanese, he said, they dump all of their products on America, but that we don't want, we can't send our stuff to them.
Exactly. So
NATO,
NATO's too weak, NATO's too old, we shouldn't have to pay for everybody else's protection. All of that started in 87, and I think, and Stone thinks, Stone firmly believes, that's when the seed was planted. He gets back to New York. He takes out a couple of full-page ads in the paper. He weighs in on the Central Park jogger case. He writes about a full-page ad about trade and everything else in the world. So Trump is laying there waiting through the birther moment in 2011, waiting in the Romney campaign. 6 days after Romney loses, Trump trademarks Make America Great Again. He tweets that night after Romney loses. He had expected to go to the party. He'd flown up to Boston to be part of it. Donald Trump has been eyeing the biggest job there is since 87, and certainly since 2011, 2012.
Although there are cynics who say that he really never expected to win the presidency. He just was hoping to enhance the brand.
Corey Lewandowski tells us in the film Tomorrow Night that, and this is his previously obscure political advisor, who says that he said to Trump, "What do you think your chances are of winning?" And Trump said, "What do you think my chances are of winning?" Lewandowski says 5%. Trump says, "Well, I would say 10%," and they agree at about 7%. So I don't think either one of them thought it was going to turn out the way it did finally.
Neil Brennan, the comedian and writer who writes for Saturday Night Live, among other places, was here after you last Tuesday. He says he thinks several celebrities could easily have won the presidency. Oprah, for example.
Well, it's an interesting question, but I think you have to do something different now, or an interesting assertion. I think you have to do something different to win, at least from what I've seen, Leonard. I've been around presidents and the presidency since Jimmy Carter, and there's something different out there now, and there's something different that Donald Trump brought to the party and received from the party. A lot of those rallies that we show in the film as he builds his self-image and his energy, he's getting and giving from those crowds, getting and giving issues, getting and giving intensity, but mostly unfiltered giving and getting a kind of anger back. And I think Oprah out there talking to people is not going to get and give anger. And I think that's something that Trump did. Remember, when he says, "I'm your voice," what he means is, "I'm going to come in here and I'm going to scream and shout and break it all down."
Although some people hear echoes of totalitarianism in things like "I'm your voice" and "America First."
Roger Stone says in our film that his speech at the convention last summer, the Trump speech, indicated that he was ready to answer the very need that Americans had, which is for a strong man. Ryan Leza, by the same token, the New Yorker writer, listening to the very same speech, says to us, "My God, he talks like a strong man." This is the divided states of America that we're talking about right here.
Since you mentioned Ryan Leza, he and Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook, mentioned people laughing at the idea following Trump's announcement of his candidacy. Why did they think it was funny?
Well, he played it a little bit, I wouldn't say as a clown, but as a comedic figure at the very beginning, coming down the escalator at the Trump Tower into the Marble Halls, saying things that a lot of people thought, well, this is just comedy. This just guy's playing it for the headline, and this will all go away very quickly, including, as we reveal in the film Tomorrow Night, in interviews with his staff, a lot of his staff who thought, "Oh, my God, why is he saying that stuff about Mexicans and others? He's done."
But when Hillary Clinton made her deplorables comment, audience laughter was clearly audible as well. Did some Americans see laughter at Trump as laughter directed at them, at average Americans?
That's a very interesting question.
Because, the people he refers to as the forgottens.
Right. He has a connection to them. He develops a connection to them that I'm not sure, obviously, I guess the vote would indicate, at least in some states, and the Electoral College would indicate that Hillary Clinton didn't connect in the same way to some of those people that certainly Trump was by calling them the forgotten. I mean, how far is the distance between the forgotten and the deplorables? Well, the forgotten says, "I'm here to help you be remembered." The deplorables says something else to them.
Wasn't Trump's entertainment value part of what got him so much attention, whether it was laughter or dismay or shock?
He's fabulous at it. When you watch the film Tomorrow Night, I mean, I was amazed. I wondered what was it that he taps into and how does he do it? I was amazed at how the rallies grow from sort of initial, he drives up in a Trump airplane and stands out and raises his hands a little bit like Nixon used to do. And it's people obviously seeing a reality TV star. But later, Leonard, as the crowds become arenas, there's something amazing about the way this guy does it.
Looking at old footage of Trump on television, on that Oprah show, he seems a lot more in control of his sentences. He is speaking, not just talking off the top of his head. Something's happened. In fact, John McWhorter wrote a piece in the Times about the way he talks these days. Is that the way he always was? Was he just more in control in 1987?
I've seen him both ways. Even now, There are times where he is extremely lucid and coherent. There are other times where he's really, you'll watch him. There's a scene in the film tomorrow night I would encourage you to just watch. He's standing there with a baseball cap on, and he's saying, drain the swamp. Pause, pause, pause. Drain the swamp. And it's like he's stuck. You know how old LP records used to get stuck. It's like he's stuck in it as the crowd is giving him call and response. But then I would encourage you to watch the next scene, which is Hillary Clinton. He hears early about the James Comey letter coming, saying they're going to continue the investigation into Hillary Clinton. This is a potential death blow to her candidacy, and he knows it. And he's standing in front of a crowd in New Hampshire right as the announcement has come on his phone, and he delivers it. We don't cut it at all. We don't manipulate it. We don't maneuver it. We just let him go. And watch him, how in control he is of every word of that indictment about her. And as his crowd rises up, it is truly a remarkable thing.
Speaking with Michael Kirk about Trump's Road to the White House, which airs tomorrow night on PBS. Mr. Kirk both directed and co-wrote it. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Michael Kirk, whose latest film, Trump's Road to the White House, airs tomorrow night on PBS stations as part of the Frontline series. He directed and co-wrote it. You mentioned the James Comey thing. Various officials in the Democratic Party have blamed Bernie Sanders, Jill Stein, Russian hacking, James Comey, the Electoral College for Hillary Clinton's loss. Is the Democratic establishment willing to look at itself?
I didn't really ask them that. Any time a party loses, even a close one, my experience is they do a certain self-examination. But who are the forces of new inside that party? Who's going to pick it up? I'm not sure, and I'm not sure they'll remake themselves. But maybe someone somewhere is leading a self-examination. We don't know about it yet.
Now, Trump, many people supported him because he was a successful businessman. The investigative reporter Wayne Barrett, who died the day before Trump took office, argued that Trump wasn't even qualified to run the Trump Organization.
Yes, I've spent a lot of time on this. We made a film, as you know, called The Choice in the fall. And we really did. We looked at the casino businesses. We looked at everything.
Which collapsed closely. And was only saved because the banks felt that the alternative, not supporting Trump and propping him up, would have been even a bigger economic disaster for them.
Exactly. He was too big to fail. And that's essentially the calculation they made, even though one banker we talked to said he was the P.T. Barnum of the age and that he was shocked and surprised that this guy was in charge of businesses, that the way he talked in the meetings with 40 bankers at Trump Tower, he said it was as if the guy had never passed a college economics class.
Trump has often responded to comments he dislikes with attacks, especially on the news media. How have voters responded to his attacks or to criticism of him in general?
You watch a lot of the rallies, and you see what happens. What Trump takes to occasionally taking on. He takes on Katie Turr from NBC, for example. Points to her in the back of the room, mocks her, challenges her, says her reporting is terrible. And we interviewed Katie, and she said that it was like an unchained beast, the crowd around her, turning at her. She's surrounded by barriers, but they're all roaring at her. And you see that happen frequently in his rallies where he says, okay, everybody, I want a thumbs up or a thumbs down on the New York Times, and the crowd just roars. So there's no love lost there, and I think he understands that that's a button he can push, going all the way back to Sarah Palin, I might add, where this was one of her regular tropes. She loved to roll out the press because in that segment of the American population, the New York Times, WNYC, PBS, we represent something that segment of the society, at least the people who were at those rallies, don't cotton to.
And mainstream media has become a pejorative term in some people's minds.
Absolutely.
A journalist.
But by the way, that's not new. That goes back to Spiro Agnew. That goes back before that. I mean, even FDR.
The nattering nabobs,
right,
of negativity.
Right. And the silent majority will speak for them. This is all familiar territory to those of us old enough to remember it.
The journalist Michael D'Antonio gave the New York Times recordings of a 2014 interview in which Trump repeatedly returned to the issue of humiliation. How does the president respond to being shown up or humiliated?
Well, we did a piece. We showed a section of the White House Correspondents' Dinner where President Obama, delivering words written by Judd Apatow and others, basically took Trump apart. This is after the birther moment, and really took him apart. In that process, Roger Stone afterwards said, we talked to many, many people who were sitting in the rows right around Trump. They said they'd never seen anything like it. The usual standard is you get mocked by the president, you go home, you cry into your pillow, and you smile a lot, and the next day you go on with your business. Trump didn't take it that way. And according to D'Antonio, who we interviewed, Donald Trump at that moment, and Roger Stone, Trump at that moment couldn't wait to be the guy who took the keys to the Oval Office from the first African-American president. He had it in for Obama at the time, according to them, felt it deeply, personally. And if you know his psychobiology and where he comes from and what his father taught him about winners and losers, you're not surprised to hear that answer.
At the CIA on Saturday, Trump referred to just taking Iraqi oil. Wouldn't that have been a violation of international law?
Whatever he said, whatever he says in circumstances like that, people we talk to say to us, never take him literally. He's trying to say something else. But the mistake the press makes is taking what he says literally. I'll leave it to you and your listeners to decide and other journalists to decide. What does that mean?
It means alternative facts.
It comes to that, too.
My guest is Michael Kirk. His latest documentary for the PBS Frontline series is called Trump's Road to the White House. It airs tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And if you just watch this film, story after story it tells, you get the feeling that there were so many turning points that should have ruined the Trump campaign that it seems almost impossible that it survived. And there's the whole business saying that John McCain was a loser because he had been a prisoner of war. And it goes on and on and on. It's just amazing that his campaign was declared dead 10 or 15 times.
At least. So you go from McCain to Megyn Kelly to the Access Hollywood video and audio. Every single one of those moments that in any other campaign you go to his fights with Marco Rubio or, you know, my hands. He's all of the uncouth.
The Gold Star family.
The Gold Star family with the cons. It just remarkable. But if you think about it from 30,000 feet and you watch it, which is what I hope your listeners will do, there is a kind of sense of it's not inevitability. It's that there is something happening in our society, in our country, that is different, and that a candidate like this, for reasons that, you know, there's lots of existential and all kinds of other metaphysical questions we could have about it, but why did this man at this time break through with this behavior? And if you believe that there's something special about the way he talks and the way he is and this whole aspect in the political world, is to answer a need, a burning need of a bunch of millions of Americans who feel voiceless and forgotten. If that's what he's about and that message is being carried by him, then in a way it answers the question of if the way he campaigned is also a precursor of the way he may govern, then what does that tell us about the way he may govern?
Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster, paraphrases Nietzsche, because I thought of that because you mentioned existentialism. whatever doesn't kill us makes us stronger. What happens to the people who aren't us?
Well, that's to remains to be seen, doesn't it?
Frank Luntz also admitted that Clinton crushed Trump in the first debate. And then there was the Access Hollywood audio released with Trump making shocking comments about women. And yet Clinton still lost.
Yes, I think Mr. Bannon, Steve Bannon, went to work with Trump in the tower that weekend before the second debate. Remember, Access Hollywood happens on a Friday. The WikiLeaks release of emails from John Podesta's email, the drip, drip, drip of those every day, is released within an hour of the Access Hollywood hitting. Then at the debate on that Sunday night, Bannon and Trump come together and bring the four women who are accusing Paula Jones and Juanita Broderick and others, Kathleen Wiley, together in front of the press right in the moments before the debate begins to make charges against Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. And Hillary knows that when she walks on that stage facing Trump, who decides to go on the offensive that night. And when you watch what happens and the difference between that and the first debate, which we show in the film, you'll see how Trump has learned a way of being and has surrounded himself with people who help him do that, that says to his voters, not to all of us necessarily, but to his voters, this is how I'm going to be. I'm going to fly in the face of convention, and here we go again.
He mocked Clinton in that second debate and walked around her, something that was made into a joke by Alec Baldwin on Saturday Night Live. But that came across differently to the political and media establishment and the people who thought, well, Trump speaks for us.
The vast majority of people who report and cover him, who work in the media, what they would call the media elites, I think do get it wrong about what the impact of what he was doing. Maybe not anymore, but what the impact of what he was doing was on people who wanted someone like that to call into question Hillary Clinton's, the legality of her actions, call into question the things she says, and make her look as programmed as she can look in his reflection. There was a lot going on there in all of those events, a lot more than we all thought, I think, when a lot of us watched it. And when you look back at it now and you know he won, it changes everything.
Frank Luntz describes Trump as extending the middle finger to the political establishment. And the New York Times recently described Trump as renouncing the nation's political class. Could his election mark a long-lasting change in the style of American politics?
Well, it's certainly done something, Leonard. I don't know if if we're in a position right now to do long-lasting. The gun just went off. But I think it is very, very, it is extraordinary what he did. And when you watch it, you realize the extent to which it wasn't just an occasional thing. It was like a strategy. It's in a way, you have 1.5 million women marching, and suddenly Sean Spicer comes out and talks about other things. This is not an accident. This is a headline grab. It's a strategy, and it's a strategy. All presidents want to fight with the press, want to control the information, want to get their agenda moving. And so in some ways, I get it. But it is a strategy. There's no sense believing that this is just occasional lightning strikes. This is something else.
He insulted a lot of the people who are going to have to work with him in Congress. For the GOP, is Trump now too big to fail?
Well, in lots of ways, it's a very interesting way to think about it. I think he is partyless in this old traditional sense. It's interesting to watch whatever Paul Ryan does right now, how that all will go. What Democrats might try to ally themselves with Trump in some way. There's doors are going to close, deals are going to be done, things are going to be hatched. Whether the press is busy chasing the size of the inaugural crowd and missing whatever that all is an obvious effort by Trump and his press and communications team right now to keep us looking at something else. It's whether, and I'm confident that real serious journalism will, substantive journalism will go looking and find things and report them as they are revealed.
And then, as we've seen in the past, Trump will simply say, it's a bunch of lies. This is the most mendacious press of scumbags, I think he used that
word. Yes, he did.
So in the end, that seems to be effective. Bloomberg News reported that billionaires who criticized Trump during the campaign are now praising him and discussing how money could be made from the rise of the populist firebrand. What happens if Trump makes the 1% even richer?
That's a fascinating, fascinating metric. What happens is it's business as usual.
By contrast, George Soros predicted that Trump will fail, but I guess Trump will divide the elite just as he has divided a lot of other people.
If we made the point in the 4 hours last week on PBS, the Divided States of America, that Obama came in naive about polarization, believing that he could unify, I've said this before, I'll say it now. Trump understands polarization. I think he uses it to great effect. Obama came to understand it, came to know that it was the case. I think Trump has always known, and we'll see what effect it has for him to use polarization as a political tool.
And the FBI reported that attacks against American Muslims surged in 2016. We just heard about bomb threats against Jewish centers across the country. Civil rights groups have chronicled a rise in attacks on minorities, verbal and physical. Has Trump given license to the bigots?
One of the things that we tested down inside the rally section of our film tomorrow night is how did Donald Trump react when there were, inevitably, protesters finally start coming to his rallies, and there are fights, and people get hurt, and people get taken out, and the crowd roars. I wanted to know, how often did Trump say, hey, everybody, calm down. This is a political dialogue. When did he do a McCain-like thing that we showed in an earlier section when McCain was running against Obama, where he stepped up and said, there is a red line in my campaign and there will be no racist remarks here about my opponent. Did Trump ever step up and do that? It was hard to find moments where Trump didn't further incite the crowds at those moments.
Michael Kirk is the director and co-writer of Trump's Road to the White House, which airs tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country as part of the PBS Frontline series. Michael, as always, it's a pleasure having you on our show. Thank you so much for coming by to talk about the film.
Thank you, Leonard.